back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. We're on our way to this conversation. I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From limiting overtesting to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues facing Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org is the Maryland State Education Association's banner. Pardon me, sorry about that, folks. There was a report that was put out about the race called Racial Wealth Divide in Baltimore. That was a pretty profound and definitive look at the depth of the wealth divide in the city, which is in some ways greater than it is in many other places in this country. And we're going to take a look at that during the course of this hour. And one of the things, you know, when you think about this in America, it's a huge issue, and it always has been a huge issue. I remember when CFED in the House now and IPS look on average that the whites in America have 7 times the wealth as African-American households, 6 times as much as Latinos. Was one stat really blew me away in this one article about this particular report. The Forbes magazine said Forbes 100 billionaires are collectively as rich as all the black American households combined. And it would take 228 years to have as much wealth as white Americans. So we start there. Dietrich Asante Muhammad's in studio, director of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative at CFED, who put out this report, Racial Wealth Divide in Baltimore. And Dietrich, good to have you in the house. Welcome.
It's good to be here. And thanks for mentioning that ever-growing gap report we did earlier with the Institute for Policy Studies. And, you know, it's six times, you know, white wealth is that of black and Latinos when you do average wealth. But if you look at median wealth, which is more reflective of how kind of the average person lives, it's even much greater, where you have black and Latino wealth at levels of a few thousand compared to white wealth at over 100,000. So I think for the average person, you even see greater wealth disparities nationwide. And the point of that report was nationwide, racial wealth inequality is growing. And so it's not, you know, oftentimes the refrain in race relations is, well, things aren't where we want them to be, but we're getting there. And we're highlighting that actually nationwide racial wealth inequality is worsening. We're not getting there. We're going in the wrong direction as it relates to African Americans and Latinos.
So, folks, we want you to join us here for this conversation at 410-319-8888 by phone. You can email us, talk@steinershow.org. You can also log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So, Dietrich, I want to go through some of the stats here that you have to kind of just put it on the table, but also then really explore, okay, so here are the stats. So now what? But before we get to now what, let's kind of look at what these stats are. I mean, they're really are pretty amazing. The liquidity stat that you all put out. And describe what that means also, the liquidity.
Yeah, so, and, you know, one thing we try to do in these reports is we highlight, I mean, we can look at income inequality, which is important, right? And the disparities between, like, the median income for African Americans in Baltimore is $33,801. And the median income for whites in Baltimore is $62,751. So blacks in Baltimore have about 54% income of whites. So there's that, and that's important to understand. But at CFED, what we recognize is we think that wealth is the key indicator in terms of financial stability, in terms of having access to opportunity. You know, and again, wealth, income is how much you make each year, but wealth is the financial resources you have to help you get through a challenging time. And oftentimes, lower income people are much more are in need of this type of liquid assets, which you were highlighting, in order to get through tough times, because oftentimes their financial situations, a lot of boom and bust up and down. And as well, that type of wealth allows you opportunities to take advantage of. And so you have some money to get a car, and so you can get this job that's a little farther out. Or you have money to go through a training program or put a down payment or a house or even an apartment in a nicer neighborhood to put the first couple months rent down. So we think wealth really is the fundamental aspect, and we see there's even greater wealth inequality in Baltimore and throughout the country than there is income inequality in Baltimore throughout the country.
When I look at household finances in this report you put out, it's interesting to me what it says about Baltimore. Let's talk a bit about why we're like this in Baltimore. So the median income, the median household income in Baltimore, is $41,000. For white families, it's $62,751.
Mm-hmm.
For black families, it's $33,801. If you look at the metropolitan region, which this is, to me, it's a just position.
Yes.
It's $83,000 for white families.
Yep.
Jumped up, obviously.
Yep.
And it's up to $47,000 for black families.
Yep.
And if you look at Maryland, it's about the same for white families, but jumped up to $58,000 for black families in the state. I think primarily because of places like Howard County and Prince George's County. And Montgomery County, which is where the heart of the black middle class and black upper middle class live in those communities.
Yes.
So what is it about Baltimore that is so far below even other black communities in the state? You know what I'm saying?
Sure,
there's something about our history, the way this place is structured, that allows this huge gap to exist.
And let me start off, which I usually don't do, on a little bit of a hopeful, optimistic note, in the sense that I do think the fact Baltimore is in a different situation than a city like Chicago or cities like Detroit, where actually statewide there's kind of much greater problems around economic opportunity, unemployment, or what have you. So I think the opportunity that Baltimore is a city that's facing great financial challenge in a state that's oftentimes ranked as having the highest income on average in the country actually provides a lot of opportunity because a lot more resources and economic opportunities that are close to the city. So I think that's a positive. I think, you know, why is Baltimore distinct from the rest of the state of Maryland? I mean, most people agree that the driving economic force in Maryland still is D.C. and has created much of the even private but public sector professional
jobs. You think more so than Baltimore?
Because
people are always using Baltimore as the economic engine of the state. You're saying it's D.C.
I would say so. Yeah, I would. I mean, now I don't think maybe historically that was true. I think in the past that you had much more, you know, when Baltimore's a stronger economic engine around manufacturing or what have you. But I would think, again, Howard County, you know, Montgomery County, it's not, I think, a coincidence that there's a lot of the counties that are, a lot of these counties were created where people are working at jobs that are either in D.C. or connected to D.C.
in the federal bureaucracy or connected to businesses in business with government contracts.
Absolutely.
Right,
absolutely.
Right, right.
And I think, and the connection, I think people start talking about this is how can you better connect what was the economic engine of the state and still the largest population center of the state more to that economic engine of D.C. and bring those opportunities. And I think, you know, in your last conversation, and in this report, we talk about historically, Baltimore was a very segregated city. It was created to kind of create opportunities for some to disenfranchise others. And we haven't really focused on how we're going to connect the because you know, African Americans came to Baltimore when there were many great jobs in Baltimore
right.
in manufacturing, right?
Because
I think there's oftentimes a critique that people in Baltimore aren't working hard enough, but they came here to do the hardest work. It is not that their value around work changed. The jobs left. Right. And we have not created a strong whether it's manufacturing or kind of middle class, working class job opportunities in Baltimore. And so you've kind of left really for generations populations who are still looking for that opportunity. And that's been the decline of Baltimore. That's what you've seen across the country is a lot of these post manufacturing cities are still suffering from not having a new sector of the economy that provides strong working class jobs. And you've also seen, you know, declines in even African American populations. Those with resources were able to move more out to the counties where there are greater opportunities.
So folks, do join us here. I want to hear your thoughts on this as this conversation unfolds at 410-319-8888. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, send an email to us at talk@steinershow.org. But do join us at 410-319-8888. I mean, when you look at these stats, and when you're sitting here on the campus of Morgan State University in this radio station, WEAA, and you see that only 14% of black folks in Baltimore have college degrees, and you sometimes forget when you live in this rarefied atmosphere in a college campus, and all these brilliant young black minds here on this campus moving ahead, professors and more,
yep.
how much of a minority that is within the city itself. That is a very mind-boggling when you think about that, right?
Absolutely.
Right?
It's 14% of Baltimore City of African Americans have a college degree or higher. That is mind-blowing that it's that stark here in Baltimore.
So, folks, your thoughts. Where do we go from here, and what does it mean? And we can talk about the history, which we can do. This is, you know, we talk about last hour of the Red Line, and I was thinking about, as he was talking about the Red Line not being built in the city, how it affects the economic development, it made me think about this talk of connection between the red lines. between the redlining that began in Baltimore City, that segregated black folks in certain places in this town, that legalized housing segregation in this country on the Baltimore model, and we couldn't even build the red line to undo red line, right?
That's very good. And this racial wealth divide data profile we did in Baltimore, we also released at the same time Chicago because it's part of a larger project. And so it is interesting looking at two cities that are different in many ways but have a long history of segregation, of intentional segregation, continued segregation, dealing with issues of violence in their cities. And just one thing I found fascinating that surprised me, because we have done these data profiles in four cities, New Orleans, Miami, and then just most recently Chicago and Baltimore, is that African Americans actually, because I think there's such a negative attitude oftentimes about where Baltimore is, that African Americans have a higher median income in Baltimore than they do in those other cities. Then in Chicago, which surprised me.
In Metro Chicago.
Well, I looked at Chicago, then we look at Chicago MSA, and Baltimore. But if you look at Baltimore, compare it to Chicago, it's only a $3,000 difference. But when you're comparing $33,000 versus $30,000, $3,000 just starts becoming somewhat significant, and much more income than the black communities in New Orleans and Miami. And so I just find that interesting because, again, I think, when we bring those cohorts together, people feel that, Baltimore's at the lowest of the low, but other cities are actually facing some of these same issues with African-American populations, even in worse situations as it relates to income. But shockingly enough, what's interesting is in Chicago as well, there is, it's still not high, but 18% of African-Americans in Chicago have a college degree or higher. And so looking at those differences, and again, I think that's because Chicago is a city that has a much stronger economy for some than Baltimore. I think if you look at all income groups in Baltimore, you see that it generally is lower, except for African Americans, actually, than it is for, like, say, whites in Chicago, what have you, because I think Chicago has sectors of its economy that is booming in a way that Baltimore does not.
And if you look at the college degrees, I mean, it's in the metropolitan area, it's 13%, and 15% statewide.
And that was just bachelor's degrees. If you're looking
those
at
are just bachelor's 13%, degrees.
If you add the 9% who have graduated or higher, then you'd be getting 22%. Of African Americans in the Baltimore MSA have bachelor degrees or higher.
Okay, right. So that means in total there's close to like 12%, 13% of African Americans in the city of Baltimore have college degrees or higher.
That's right. That's right.
Well, let's, folks, your thoughts on this and where this goes at 410-319-8888. Let's go to Janet. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for accepting my call.
Thanks for calling.
Just a side note for the college grads. Are they giving the same opportunities for employment and for gainful employment versus obviously maybe relegated to maybe lower paying positions for college degrees? But what I really wanted to talk about was what are you guys' thoughts about the communities, the black communities, particularly the home owners in Baltimore, whereas in their communities, there's no investment going on. Therefore, the accumulation of wealth through your home is almost nullified in Baltimore. What and how can we address those types of disparities? Somebody that's in a black community owns a home, and they do everything they can do to fix up their home to improve their community, but the surrounding area is full of blight. What can we do to change those dynamics so that we can maybe have some equity in our homes and bring equity to the situation?
That's a great question.
Yeah, no, I think you bring up a really important point. And another point, again, there's great inequality in Baltimore, but also I think there's some signs of hope in that Baltimore City has a black homeownership rate. I know you're talking about a little different issue, but I'll get to your issue. A black homeownership rate of around 42%, which is about the national average of African-American homeownership, 43%. And for a city, that's a pretty high black homeownership rate. So unlike most cities where you're dealing with issues about how can we get, and in Baltimore, you still want more homeownership for African-Americans, but and you're dealing much more with the issue of how can you maintain
households, right.
Yes, that's
right.
Households. Right. And how can you maintain a black home ownership in Baltimore, as well as make sure that the returns on their investment start getting closer to what white Americans have. Because, again, we talk oftentimes nationally or locally about a home ownership divide, a racial home ownership divide, where nationwide white Americans have about 70% home ownership rate. And, again, black Americans have 43, 44% home ownership rate. But what it's not talked about enough is that the return on investment, that the median, and we have this in this report here, the median property value for African Americans is $120,000 for a home in Baltimore, while for whites, it's $200,000. And so it's, you know, we need to look at, I think this gets to some of the conversations, discussions around development. What are we doing in development to make sure that lower property values are being supported so that actually the property values can be raised instead?
What does that mean, supported?
Okay, instead of just raising property values and displacing people who can no longer afford to live in that area. So what are some practical things of that can be done to help support? And I think it would be looking at Baltimore City homeowners today and putting more investments and opportunities, whether it's through loans, interest-free loans, what have you, so that people can fix up their houses. And as you have a multi-income development happening in a neighborhood, people just aren't pushed out and have to sell out immediately. But they can actually, as a neighborhood increases in value, they can ride that wave. Because too oftentimes, as neighborhood values is increasing, people don't have enough money to pay on the taxes, or and particularly the increasing taxes as property values rise. The people that were managed to be homeowners at when the property value was low are pushed out and never get the return that new residents who are coming in who have money are able to get on their homes.
So when you look at the history of why this is here, the history of this city, the history of this country, I mean, post-World War II, FHA loans, loans to veterans went to white veterans.
Yes.
Which helped build a wealth base among white working class, white middle class, that didn't exist among the black middle class and black working class. The difference between Turner Station and Dundalk. Mm-hmm. As an example mm-hmm. of how those mm-hmm. two places developed, right?
Yes.
On the east side of our community. So, and that had to do with the wealth divide, even though, I mean, there are a lot of poor white families who are struggling as the working class. It helped create this divide that's very real. So if that's part of our reality, part of our reality, as you point out here in the report, where the disparities exist in terms of abandoned housing and communities and how that affects wealth and community. So. If we know all these things, what are the proposals about what to do to begin to ameliorate this, to change it, and create equity? If that earlier report you did said it would take 230 years to catch up for black folks to catch up income wise to the rest of white America, well, we don't have 230 years.
And it was 230 years for African Americans to catch up to white wealth today.
Today,
it wasn't in 230 years that African Americans would find equality with whites in wealth. It would mean, you know, someone said to me yesterday, so we need 230 years and a time machine for African Americans to catch the wealth of whites. And so
we can get Afrofuturist perspective.
Yeah, that's right.
On this,
that's right.
So what does that mean practically, though? So how does that change? And what is it? We have a city and state where there is in establishment in the world of the political establishment. And a black political power exists
mm-hmm.
in very concrete
mm-hmm.
ways.
Mm-hmm.
That is not translated mm-hmm. into dealing with the question of the wealth divide.
And this isn't unique, right?
No, it's not unique.
This is something that's true throughout the city, as Detroit, what have you. Black power accumulated, but economic inequality wasn't bridged.
So where's the bridge?
Got it. So first, I just want to say, we put these reports out as a way to kind of have more clarity on the conversation, not like this isn't a heavily solution-focused.
No, I understand that.
It's a solution-focused report, and it's part of a over year-long project where we're working with local nonprofits. We're going to have ongoing dialogues where we hope that there can be more focused solutions around this. But I think, you know, I think we can start getting to the solutions is what we're highlighting is that unless there's not intentional, strong action, the same type of intentional, strong action that was created to create the American middle class nationwide, if we don't have intentional, strong actions to deal with racial wealth inequality, it's not something that will just solve itself by bringing in some developments here or there and thinking that too oftentimes we say our cities are doing better when poor people are pushed out and higher income people are brought in, and we say that's development.
Right.
And what we're trying to highlight is, racial wealth divide is so deep and so intense that unless you have focused efforts looking at how policies are going to affect the communities who are here, and if you really want a multiracial, multi-class community, and, you know, I grew up in Columbia, Maryland, outside of Baltimore. I think there are some lessons that there were some successes there where they were very intentional about making sure single-family homes were next to townhomes, were next to apartments. All these people were going to the same types of schools, not overly concentrating lower-income areas here. So you'd have worse schools here and better schools there. So I think it has to be at kind of every level of planning, of development, of jobs. And I haven't, and I think that's what's going to be needed more in Baltimore and in cities across the country, a laser-like focus on addressing this disparity.
Well, because we lost already, but let's say politically speaking in Baltimore, when we had the battle over the public funding, the TIF funds for Port Covington.
Yes.
The political struggle and the economic struggle was lost. It was not won.
Yes.
I mean, changes were made, but it wasn't won because you didn't force you didn't force Kevin Plank and the developers to insist on creating a mixed income, mixed racial community in Port Covington.
Yes.
So you'll have a predominantly white, wealthy community with a minority of wealthy black folks in that community and no working class people, no middle class people living in affordable housing in Port Covington. So that was lost. I mean, so the question, it becomes a political question of how you enforce development to be different. So it doesn't do that.
Well, and I think you have to, even more pointedly, and I hope the report highlights this, that if you're not doing a development project that is focused on bridging racial wealth inequality, you're doing a development project that's investing in keeping and maintaining racial
and
wealth
inequality.
And maybe widening it. And more likely than not, widening it. Absolutely. And we have to make it that stark, that you're either helping address racial wealth inequality or you're strengthening racial wealth inequality, racial economic inequality. And to me, racial economic inequality is the foundation of racial inequality in this country. So if you're not addressing these issues, then actually you're investing in maintaining racial inequality. And you can talk more largely too, class inequality. So we have to draw these stark political lines and ask people what side are they on.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Talib, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you.
How
are you?
Very well. Good. Welcome to the show.
Good.
Oh, I believe Talib is...
Talib, you're one of the guests. You're a guest for the next segment. I'm sorry. I didn't see that. It just said listening to the show on here. So I'm sorry, but welcome. Good to have you with us. So do we have a name for line three, or is it line five? Do we have another? Let's take the break and then come back and get these callers lined up. And we'll be back and introduce Talib to the rest of the community as well. Stay
very
with us.
Good.
Don't go away. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. We are looking at the report that was put out by the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative about the black-white income gap and wealth gap in our community and in Baltimore very specifically. They've been doing this across the country, and it's called the Racial Wealth Divide in Baltimore. Dietrich Asante Muhammad is director of that, and he's author of this report. We're now joined by Talib Horn, who's executive director of Bond Secures Community Works. Good to have you with us, Talib. I misunderstood this. I thought first when I looked at the screen that you were a caller with a comment, but it's good to have you with us here. But we do want you to call in with the comments at 410-319-8888. We want to hear what your thoughts are. We have people calling all the time talking about listeners calling in and talking about the disparities of what white supremacy has created in our communities, that it's the heart of this. The question is, we have these stats in front of us. What do we do about these stats? Let's talk a bit about where they come from and what we do to end this and your thoughts and ideas about that. We have to have a really kind of creative way of looking at this. I mentioned Port Covington and what I thought was the failure there of this city to really address what they could have done in a major way. Instead, I think we're going to build another divide, another enclave of wealth, mostly white wealth, that does not have to do anything for working class black folks in this town. What are your thoughts about how to change that? At 410-319-8888, tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can also send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. And some of those calls coming in, when I get to them at 410-319-8888.
And so, Mark, I was wondering if I could just kind of highlight that.
Please.
That, you know, this report, this racial wealth divide data profile for Baltimore, is part of a project we call Building High Impacts Nonprofits of Color. And we're doing this, as again mentioned, in these four cities, New Orleans, Miami. We just launched Baltimore and Chicago. And we, you know, we believe that, you know, part of the work to be done is that just as households of color are oftentimes have disproportionately less wealth, less resources, less social network to take advantage of economic opportunity, it's also true that our own institutions and nonprofits, nonprofits of color, don't have the type of resources and investments that are needed. And even though there's oftentimes money that will be flying into a city to address the problems, it's not organizations of color that are getting it that usually have the best grassroots connections that are most likely to hire people from communities. So the way that we're trying to, not just putting out a report highlighting racial wealth divide, but we're working with groups like Bon Secours Community Works that Talib directs in trying to strengthen their capacity as a nonprofit and help them with a stronger analysis around asset development, racial wealth inequality, and put them on a path to have better resources to better address these issues.
Talib?
Yeah, well, thank you for giving this opportunity to talk a little bit about what we do, and I really applaud Dietrich in this report, and it really talks about addressing economic disparities. So really fast, in terms of what Bon Secours Community Works is doing to address some of these economic disparities. We are an organization that is in Southwest Baltimore. Around 30 years ago, our hospital really wanted to focus in on the social determinants of health. So they created a 20,000 square foot building right on North Fulton Street. And in this particular facility, we do financial services. So we offer any West Baltimore resident one-on-one financial coaching, free tax preparation. We do our earned benefits assessment. We're the largest provider of eviction prevention classes and dollars. We will give up to $700 for an individual who's about to be evicted as long as they take a one-on-one financial coaching session with us. We also have a community job hub. When you look at the data, it says, you know, the unemployment rate for African Americans probably triple that in terms of Baltimore to other races. And so what West Baltimore residents need are access to jobs and employment. So we have certification, training, and then we also focus others on jobs. We also have family support services. A lot of times barriers to employment are affordable child care. So we have an early Head Start program in Southwest Baltimore where we service every day 108 individuals ages 0 to 5. And so, you know, we look at these, all these, you know, programs as programs that we need to do in West Baltimore to address economic disparities.
And let me open the phones here again at 410-319-8888. Let's go to Ray on line 5. You're on the air. Welcome, Ray.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking the call. Hi, I'm calling. I'd like to make a statement.
Sure.
What's interesting in Baltimore is that you can see, for the most part, the majority of the minority communities in Baltimore City have viable economic engines. They are enclaves that have been completely and continually developed. When you look at Hamden, when you look at Remington that's coming on, and you look at Little Greek Town, and so on and so forth. But what is not happening, it seems, is the development of economic engines in historically black communities. I give you the last discussion about the Red Line. I work day in and day out at Midtown Edmondson, and that's a hub. When you talk about rail, rail is firmly established in Midtown with regards to the Mark Station that takes people 600 to 800 people daily to Washington, D.C. It is applaudable that they haven't really redeveloped that neighborhood. It has at least two viable economic engines that could be redone, the Ward's Bakery, that could hire a number of people if it was properly developed with regards to health and or economic development.
Right.
And so it seems like is a deliberate mess. They deliberately not are trying to bring up the black community. And I'm one of the signers of the complaint of the red line. And I did that purposely because working in this neighborhood and have been in this neighborhood for over 30-some years, and to see that there's actual infrastructure that could rebuild this neighborhood, it makes for a very sad situation with regards to, you know, having infrastructure that actually could pinpoint how why it is that people continue to invest here.
So I think you raise a really important issue here. I mean, I've talked to the same people, talked to folks who were on the show not long ago who wanted to talk about the same issue in a larger sense about the redevelopment of the west side around North and Pennsylvania Avenue that is not being developed. Mm-hmm. Also around another stop that could be developed. And one of the things that Ray said here, I think, Dietrich, is really, really telling, which is people feel it's almost on purpose that Black communities are not included in development plans when it comes to rebuilding and creating viable economies in this city.
Yes. And I would think, and again, I think this is something we're seeing throughout the country. You know, I wouldn't prescribe people's intentionality or not. I think oftentimes you have high-income white developers, and their idea of development is having other high-income people move in, you know, and that is, you know, the kind of maybe unintentional or intentional development plan. I think, again, in Baltimore, there's a lot of opportunities because actually Maryland has one of the stronger Black middle classes in the country. And if people could expand their minds about what development means, you could strengthen middle class, high income African American communities. If people have a more visionary idea, they can think of what does it really mean to have a multi-class, multi-income development, you know. And I think that's a challenge. Again, I really haven't seen across the country in any particular large way how, you know, a city or a large part of a city that's been developed, that's really brought forward people of different incomes and races together. I mean, again, I can highlight some of the successes that Columbia has had historically, but I think even that has kind of declined over time as private market forces have taken over and the idea of socioeconomic inclusion has less been at the forefront. But I do think organizations like Bon Secours, like the other organizations, I'll just name real quick the other five organizations we work with: Center for Urban Families, Druid Heights Community Development, Latino Economic Development Center. So we are trying to deal with some of the issues around the Latino community. And this data profile does have information around the Latino community in Baltimore. Muse 360 Arts and Urban Alliance, I think they all are doing some economic programs, but oftentimes they're at a much smaller scale. And the question is, when is the city going to look at them as partners to strengthen and to bring to a larger scale economic successes they're engaging?
But part of the question is here, it reminds me of the discussion we had last hour on the future of transportation. And they were in agreement on some things, but very stark disagreements on certain areas about where to put the thrust. So on the one hand is to fight for the red line because we need rail to make the future of the city work. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we said, well, the reality is the red line's going to come back for a while because politically it's just not going to happen. It's going to take a while to build that coalition, but we have the link plan that we have to force the governor to make really work for the city. So I say the analogy here is that we need to push for development that has mixed income and mixed race in this town so it doesn't just become white development. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, why is it so difficult to put development money in Garrison Liberty Heights, Edmondson Village, other places in the community that are vast majority Black communities? Is it not viable economically? Can it not be done? If it can be done, why is that development money not there? And what blocks that from happening? Because it seems to me that isn't a way that you begin to build Black wealth, by having communities where there are jobs that actually take place in the community, expand out. People can have businesses. I mean, your own report talks about how Black businesses make less money than white businesses.
That's right.
Small businesses, right?
That's right.
So something has to change that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think a quick answer is that you can make more money more quickly by developing expensive housing for rich people. There is a quick return, right? And that's why it requires government to push forward social good. If you're just talking about economic returns, private market will do that, and it's just much easier to create a little mansion, you know, and that's very expensive, and you can get a higher profit margin on that. That's why you have to have strong government push if you want to have median income, lower income households. But again, if if we don't like the great division, the growing division that's happening across this country economically and socially, we have to, again, push forth this idea that government is going to hold developers accountable to do this, because they won't do it on their own. And they haven't. That's right.
On the way back to Florence, Libby, did you want to jump in on that at all?
Well, yeah. I also think that, you know, I work for Anchor Institution, Bon Secours, and we have developed, as a hospital through a subsidiary, close to 800 units of affordable housing around our hospital. And that is not the norm for hospitals and anchor institutions to delve into affordable housing. But because of the need for the community, it took a lot of courage for us to do, but we did it because it was the right thing. And with a partnership with Enterprise Housing, we are one of the larger developers in our particular neighborhood. And so I also think that we can't depend on the city to solve all this. I think other anchor institutions have to, invest in the neighborhood that their facilities are and build some of these housing. And so that's something that Bon Secours has been doing for years.
No, and again, I think that's really important. I think, again, what we do need the city for is to help to bring that to larger scale. So it's just not piecemeal projects. But again, you know, there are some positive private forces out there doing some good things. How do we make that bigger so it has a bigger impact?
410-319-8888. Tom, you're on the air. Welcome. Good morning, Tom. You're on the air.
I think that on economic inequality, I think in general, in the capitalistic system, economic inequality is acceptable. We see that every day. It's the engine of production. So the political organizations in the state have to guarantee this inequality, because theoretically, inequality brings richness in the capitalistic system.
True. So does that mean we can't do anything until we overthrow it? Right.
Well, and I'll put forward, too, that the There'll always be some economic inequality, and I'm actually fighting for this idea that everyone will have the exact same amount. But there hasn't been this level of economic inequality in quite a long time overall.
Right.
And the idea, and I think most of us would agree, that the racial wealth inequality that derives from racism is not something that is positive for even the development of the economy or the country or the city. And these things need to be addressed. So it's not, you know, are we going to have economic inequality or not? But it's at what level are we going to allow it to go and continue to grow? And when does it become a big enough hindrance? And I think it is starting to become a big enough hindrance that it actually impedes economic growth. I mean, again, America has been celebrated because of a strong middle class, not because America had the greatest economic inequality in the world. Most of the economies that have the greatest economic inequality in the world don't have an overall economy nearly as strong as the United States has been historically. So it's how we're dealing with
and
that.
And somehow we're not building on that here in Baltimore on the way back to the phones, because Baltimore historically for the last 150 years or whatever that is, if my math is correct, has had one of the oldest, strongest black middle class communities in the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, we forget Baltimore before the Civil War had the largest free population of African Americans of any place in America. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's a long history here.
And I think there's a lot of opportunity, I do think, in Baltimore, because, again, Maryland has one of the strongest black middle classes in the country. And I think, actually, this could be a leader. Baltimore City is actually well-positioned to be a leader in how to address racial economic inequality because of the makeup of Baltimore and of Maryland. It's just the question is, are we going to be bold enough to take that advantage of that opportunity?
Let's back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Michael, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hey, good morning.
Morning. My common question was about the inequality. I was hearing the speaker earlier say the inequality was, the racial inequality was coming primarily from economic inequality, and he resisted from commenting on the motives or the intentions that economic inequality comes from. But I really think that it's quite clear it's stemming from racism, prejudice, and discrimination. And if we continue to address economic inequality as though it's standing by itself, that will continue to fail like we've been doing for the last 30 years or so. And so despite laws changing so that black people can no longer be redlined out of certain neighborhoods, that doesn't change the society, that doesn't change people's hearts and minds. And so I wonder why we should focus on these economic injustices apart from the racial injustices that drive them, because there will always be some other ostensible justification for why the city and government and state don't invest in predominantly black communities. Maybe it's not safe. Maybe there's not enough wealth there. Maybe it's because of the nepotism in corporate development. And the list can go on and on, but the real reason underlying it all, I think, is racial prejudice.
Yeah, so just to respond to that, I don't think I'm hesitant at all to connect economic inequality to racial inequality. I'm the director of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative at CFED. The whole focus is on racial economic inequality. I don't oftentimes try to push about whether in the developer's head, whether they are prejudiced or don't like black people or Latino people as the, you know, underlying force, because to me, it doesn't even really matter. What matters is the results. Are we increasing racial equity, or are we increasing racial inequality? I don't care if you do it by accident, if you're doing it on purpose. I care much more about the result. And I think, and you know, our work, Ever Growing Gap, highlights that whatever people's personal motivations are, the truth is we're strengthening racial inequality in this country, and that we can't do economic development, economic planning without looking at racial economic inequality and how we're going to address communities that have historically been disenfranchised due to white supremacy. So I hope I don't come off as a conservative as you're making me. I just don't feel there's a lot of a need for me to assign read the people's minds of why they're doing it. I'm just highlighting the effect, and it's creating greater economic inequality, greater racial inequality, and we need to address these issues.
Before we get to the final call in here for this segment, Talib, do you want to jump in on that at all as well?
No. Well, if I just want to say that CFED. This program really has an opportunity to help us as an organization increase our capacity, and so we are focusing on the addressing economic disparities. But the other thing that they're doing is they're giving us resources so that we can do our job better. And I think if organizations do our job better, a lot of these issues will turn the tide. We are an organization that services close to 3,000 individual Southwest Baltimore residents a year. Through this program, we're learning about fundraising, we're learning about board development, we're learning about human resources. They really are investing in an organization to get to the next level to focus on this. So I just want to applaud CFED that they chose Baltimore. There were a lot of other cities that they could have chose, and I also applaud them that they really looked at investing in a cross section of organizations to make better to focus on this. So those would be a final comment.
And if you don't mind, I want to highlight again another racial component that we're trying to engage is that even as we're giving money to provide services to people of color, we oftentimes won't fund and invest in the organizations of color that have a history of doing it. So that's just another aspect of racial inequality. Even in the nonprofit sector, we're not investing like we should in nonprofits of color.
So let me try to get one quick call in here before we go to our next segment. 410-319-8888. Janet, you're on the air. Welcome. Janet, you there? Hello, Janet? Oh, you're not there. All right. We need to link this report. So tell folks how they can get this report and look at it themselves.
Sure. They can go to www.cfed.org/RWD for Racial Wealth Divide. They can check out our Facebook page, Bridging the Racial Wealth Divide. You can just Google the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative of CFED. We also have a podcast where we regularly discuss these issues, the Race and Wealth Podcast. You can get on iTunes and Stitcher and those types of places.
So, Diedrich Asante Mahama, it's always good to have you in the house. Great to have you. The work you're doing is really important. I appreciate it. Good seeing you again, too.
Yeah, no, it's good to be here in person. It's great.
So Diedrich Asante Mahama is director of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative of CFED. We'll also be linking to that on our website, asanashow.org. And we want to thank Talib Horn for joining us here, executive director of Bon Secours Community Works. Talib, great to have you on the air with us as well.
Thank you.
And Diedrich, we'll look forward to some business. Let's keep this up.
Yes, sir. Look forward to it.
Look forward to it, too. Take a very short break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Lisa Snowden-McRae, writer and associate editor for the City Paper. Stay with us.